All right, we're in Judges chapter 1. Judges chapter 1 is where we are. We did the first portion of this last week. And we said that Judges chapter 1 is the continuation of the story. That is, it's the continuation of the story from Joshua. Or in some cases, maybe, you know, filling in a few blanks. If we go back as far as Joshua 15 and 16, that's kind of a summary. And then there were more details added in Joshua 17, 18, 19, 20, 21. But, you know, we get a little more details here in Judges chapter 1. Last time we looked at the first 10 verses or so, but we saw the continuation of the story. And then what we see in verses 1 and 2 is clear direction from God. When they sought God and said, who should be the first to go up into their inheritance? God very clearly said in verse 2, Judah shall go up. Behold, I've delivered the land into his hand. So God directed Judah to go first. And, you know, Judah was to be an example, I think, a challenge to the other tribes. But I also think that this was a reward because Joshua was the leader of the people upon the death of Moses. But the other faithful spy who was a great leader and a godly example was Caleb. And Judah was the tribe to which Caleb belonged. And so I think God, you know, allowed Judah to go up partly for that reason, but also so they'd be a challenge. So what we start with in verse 3 and goes all the way down to around verse 20 or so is the conquest of Judah. We talked about part of this last time. Judah told his brother Simeon, hey, go with me and I'll help you. And that's because Simeon, his inheritance was within the area that had been given to Judah as well. So in verses 8, 9, 10, 11, some of the conquered areas are listed. Bezek, Jerusalem, Hebron, Debir, some of those areas are listed. Now, it's kind of interesting. Jerusalem was right on the border, as I understand it, between Benjamin and Judah. So, I mean, if you think about it in modern-day terms, if we talk about the city, whether we talk about Charlotte, whether we talk about Philadelphia, where the Loves lived for a long time, or any other large city with which you're familiar, there's the city proper, which is the city limits, and then there's, you know, what's considered the Charlotte area or the Philly area, the suburbs. So very often, where do you live? Well, I live in Charlotte. Well, what's your address? Well, it might say Mint Hill or Concord or Huntersville or whatever, but you know, it's these the suburbs or the surrounding. The border that was drawn for Judah and Benjamin went very, very close to the city of Jerusalem itself. So like the valley around it or some of the surrounding areas and to the south there were part of Judah's inheritance. The city proper, or the fortress that sat on a hill that eventually became David's capital, was part of what was given to Benjamin. So that's why sometimes you read, well, they didn't occupy Jerusalem, or you know, the Benjamites didn't have Jerusalem, or whatever. There's, you know, a little bit of overlapping interests there, but nonetheless, we left off around verse number 11. So let's pick up there today. And from thence he went against the inhabitants of Debir, and the name of Debir before was Kirjath-Sefer. So Debir was the name that it was changed to. Verse 12, Caleb said, he that smiteth Kirjath-Sefer and taketh it, to him will I give Aksah my daughter to wife. And Othniel, the son of Kenaz, Caleb's younger brother, took it, and he gave him Aksah his daughter to wife. And it came to pass when she came to him that she moved him to ask her father a field. And she lighted from off her ass, and Caleb said to her, what wilt thou? And she said unto him, give me a blessing, for thou hast given me a south land. Give me also springs of water. And Caleb gave her the upper springs and the nether springs. So we see here a little more insight into the conquest of the portion of Caleb. Okay, Caleb offered an incentive, he that smiteth Kirjath-Sefer. Apparently this was a difficult area in there, but he that smiteth Kirjath-Sefer, I will give my daughter to wife. Now, this way of thinking is just totally foreign to me. Okay, I mean, how would you feel? Okay, I've got a contest. I've got a prize. I'm going to tell you what we're going to do. We're going to attack Kirjath-Sefer, and whoever it is that leads his group of men successfully, I have a reward. You can marry my daughter. I mean, we don't do things quite like that today, right? I mean, what would you think, ladies, if you're the daughter? Well, great. I am bait. Or you're thinking, you start looking around going, yeah, maybe, eh. Oh, please, no. definitely not. You know, you start thinking along those lines too, right? So, I mean, it's like, Dad, if you really loved me, you wouldn't do this to me. I mean, I wonder about the family dynamics of all this kind of stuff too, right? So here's the daughter who has no say in this at all. So, you know, the men of Judah go and fight. And who was successful in the conquest of Kirjath-Sefer? According to verse 12, it was Othniel, the nephew of Caleb. So he led his group successfully. He conquers Kirjath-Sefer. And the prize is he gets to marry his cousin. Right? I mean, my nephew is cousin to my children. So the prize for winning the battle was he got to marry his cousin. So yes, Alabama and West Virginia are mentioned in the Bible, just not by name. Okay. So, I mean, when you think about it, hey, he won the prize, he got the pretty girl and all of this. Yeah, I mean, did you ever stop and think about the fact that he got to marry his cousin? What a blessing. So Othniel was the winner. And then verse 14, it came to pass when she came to him, she moved him to ask of her. So she had been given a piece of land for them to inherit and to live. But it says, it's kind of interesting. Verse number 15, she said unto him, give me a blessing. Well, he already gave her a piece of land. But notice what the next phrase is. For thou hast given me a south land. The word for south in Hebrew is the word Negev. Have you ever heard that word before? The Negev? Okay, that's a region, south of Israel proper. Let me see if I can pull it up on the map here. I got the map on here. Let me fast forward a couple slides and get here. But I cut the bottom of this off, right where the green area is there in the bottom. Hebron is above that. Hebron is between, I can zoom in a little bit, I think. Let's try this here. There we go. If you have like 40/20 eyesight, you could probably read that. But Hebron is right there about halfway up the Dead Sea, between the green and the brownish color that looks like a soapbox derby car. Okay, Hebron's like right in the middle of there. Well, that was the area that was given to Caleb specifically, all the area that's pinkish purplish there, whatever color that looks like to you, that was the land that was given to Judah. But basically south of that green area and southwest down towards the Nile River, that area was called the Negev. It was not fully desert, but it was what we call wilderness. Almost desert levels of rainfall, less than 10 inches a year. There was some scrub plants, and you could graze animals there if you were judicious and careful about how you moved them around and planned it out. But that area was also, as I understand it, more susceptible to bandits, and the Bedouin tribes would come through and steal and that kind of thing. So eventually, as you get into the history of Israel, that part was more left alone. Some of the early fathers in Israel did travel through there, but my point is this, the term Negev or Southland here, I don't know that it refers to that proper as much as it was saying, well, you've given me a land that's like the Negev. In other words, it's not as abundant with water and grass for the crops and all that kind of thing. So what did she ask for? Give me springs of water. Okay, so obviously the Negev, that's going to be poor quality or more barren type area. If you have springs of water, you can irrigate, right? You can water your animals, you can water your crops, and then you have the capability to be fruitful if you work the land and manage it well. But what she said here, I think you've given me a south land. I think that phrase means you did give me a piece of land, but it's not ideal. Would you give us springs of water as well? Verse The end of verse 15, Caleb said unto her, Caleb gave her the upper springs and the nether springs. That word nether means lower. And so he gave her, I don't know exactly what it is, but he gave her additional property that had upper and lower springs to it. So, I mean, that was an ideal setup in an agricultural and farm type setting. So anyway, Othniel has won the contest. He has got the bride. They have a piece of land, and now they're off to have children cousins, I guess. Anyway, we won't follow that line of thought anymore. But you have one specific little window here into the family of Caleb. But it's mentioned a little bit later on in the chapter as well. But Caleb had specifically told, when he went to Joshua, this is recorded back in Joshua, I think it's Joshua 14 or 15. He said, you heard that that land over there was the land of giants. He said, give me the land of the giants. He said, God will help me. We'll drive them out. And basically, I think Caleb wanted to be an example. I want to show people that God can do this. And, maybe they'll take courage from this and move forward into theirs as well. So Hebron and the surrounding areas were, the sons of Anak, the sons of the giants. Here you get a little window into that. Verse 16, the children of the Kenite, Moses' father-in-law, went up out of the city of palm trees with the children of Judah into the wilderness of Judah, which lieth in the south of Arad, and they went and dwelt among the people. Best I can tell, the city of palm trees here is the area of Jericho. I mean, they've already destroyed the city proper of Jericho, but best I can tell, that's the only city that's given by name that was a city of palm trees. If there were others, then I wasn't able to find it. But the children of the Kenite, Moses' father-in-law, you remember who that was? Remember his name? Jethro, the priest of Midian. So apparently, Moses kept his flocks for 40 years in the wilderness and married one of his daughters, and they had two sons. You remember when Moses was going back down to Egypt, the angel met him and confronted him because of the circumcision? It was an area of disobedience. I think it was because his wife was like, you're crazy, you're not doing that to my kid. But whatever the case, it seems like he sent her back to her dad and he went down to Egypt by himself. But once they go down there and you have the confrontations with Pharaoh and you have all the plagues and everything, well then, when they came out of Egypt, they crossed the Red Sea, you have the story of the bitter water and the first couple of stories there. Well then, long about Exodus 17 or 18, somewhere along in there, Moses' father-in-law shows up and brings his wife and two sons back, and the family's reunited. Moses' father-in-law was also the one who gave him advice when he watched how Moses sat all day, every day, and all the people brought all their complaints and problems, and he said, look, you're going to wear yourself out to nothing. You need to make, in essence, lower courts, and you be the Supreme Court. I'm using modern-day terminology. You need to set up other judges and let them help people and have them only bring the hardest of cases to you. And Moses listened to him. And it was interesting, when Jethro was introduced in the story of Exodus, he's called the priest of Midian. Okay, very likely an idolatrous priest. But when he showed up and he saw Israel come out and he heard about all the things God had done in the plagues and the crossing of the Red Sea and all those kinds of things, he made a statement, your God's the true God, and he offered a sacrifice to the God of Israel. So, I mean, it's quite possible that he began to follow the God of Israel at that point, but the children of the Kenite, Moses' father-in-law, who's that? It's Moses' in-laws, an extended family, maybe his wife's brothers or sisters or some of the grandkids, but it's some of the extended family on the side of Moses' wife had stayed with Israel then. I mean, the early story was, before the spies went in and before the 40 years wandering in the wilderness. But one of the statements that Moses had made to his father-in-law was, if you stay with us, you can be to us for eyes. Read that back in Exodus. I mean, so it's very possible that his father-in-law and maybe some of the other family became, if I could say it this way, their guides in the wilderness. I mean, obviously they're following the cloud as they move from place to place, but you know, they're the ones that knew the area where you could find a natural spring of water. I mean, how many times did God give them water out of a rock?
Twice.
I mean, other times they had to have sources of water and different things. I mean, it's very possible that Moses' in-laws knew the area well enough to say, all right, if we're camping here, the best place to graze your animals is here, and there's water here and here, and they were kind of their guides in the wilderness. But nonetheless, they were still part of the group here at this part of the story, which means they had been around at least through the conquest of Canaan and the years to follow, however long Joshua lived, assuming that he was around the same age as Caleb, then this is probably, I think, 30 years after they went into the promised land or something like that. But anyway, that's who's mentioned here in verse number 16. And Judah, verse 17, went with Simeon his brother. They slew the Canaanites that inherited Zarephath and utterly destroyed it. And the name of it was called Hormah. Verse 16, you have the mention of Arad. That city, Arad, is also mentioned in Numbers chapter 21 in their earlier travels as a group that had attacked Israel and they had defeated them. So apparently, you know, they came back a little bit and are dealing with them years later as well. So verse 18, also Judah took Gaza with the coast thereof, and Ashkelon with the coast thereof, and Ekron with the coast thereof. Now we haven't heard anything at all about Gaza in the news in the last 2 years, haven't we? It's been all over the news. And if I can go back to the map here for a second, Gaza is in roughly the same area. Do you see? You see the big wording there that's kind of on an angle there? It says Philistia. And that's where the Philistines were. So you see almost directly over from the PH of Philistia there, right along the coast, there's Gaza. And then up the coast from that a little ways is Ashkelon. The third city that's mentioned here is Ekron. And Ekron was inland from those two, about halfway north and south, about almost halfway or a little more in between them, but inland several miles. So that's an area there near the coast. But that was part of the area that was given to the tribe of Judah. So they started out and they began to drive out some of these different groups. But here, verse 18, Gaza, Ashkelon, and Ekron. You know, we look at that and go, God promised to give Israel this land. And, you know, they had a right to it. They drove them out. And see, here's a historical record that they were living there 3,000 years ago. Those that have a religious predisposition against Israel or a political predisposition of Israel, we'll look at it and say, look, there's proof that other people were living there before Israel, and Israel was the invaders, and that Israel should be driven out and should be given back to the original people groups. I mean, God is the one that said he's going to give this land to Israel. If we get crossways with that, we will lose more of God's blessings than we already have as a nation. But God has given that land. But you see here the Philistines. You can see, I can see, some of you may be able to see, you see the PHI of Philistia, well, just to the right of the I of the PHI, that's the town of Gath. There's somebody that's fairly well known in the Bible that was from Gath. You know who that was, right? Yeah, that was Goliath. But that area there from Gath all the way over to the coast, there's Gath, Ekron, Ashkelon, Gaza, and Ashdod, which is a little further north up the coast. Those were the five royal cities of the Philistines. So, that area was given to Judah. They had some initial success, but we also see that when David becomes king, he's still dealing with the Philistines. So they weren't completely driven out until David became king. It was early in the first 5 or 10 years of David being king that the Philistines were really subdued and you don't hear much about them anymore. But anyway, verse number 18 was the Philistine cities. Verse 19, the Lord was with Judah, and he drave out the inhabitants of the mountain, but could not drive out the inhabitants of the valley because they had chariots of iron. And they gave Hebron unto Caleb, as Moses said, and he expelled thence the three sons of Anak. So, verse 20 is kind of a summary. It's interesting here, it says, as Moses said. So apparently there was a conversation with Moses. And then later he went back to Joshua and said, I want this. And Joshua said, yeah, you can have it. But the three sons of Anak were the main, you know, heads of the families. There were others. In fact, when you get, you know, further down into the time of David, you still had the descendants of Anak, Goliath, and others that was still the descendants of the giants. But verse 19, the Lord was with Judah, and he drove out the inhabitants of the mountain, but could not drive out the inhabitants of the valley. Does that mean God was not able? Of course not. What does that mean? It means there was a lapse on the part of the children of Judah. Okay? A lapse of faith, maybe a lapse of resolve. All of you who have, you know, you have children or you have observed kids, you've observed human nature. Got a duplicate there, don't I? You've observed, you know, human nature. You know that sometimes when things come easier, you know, what's the tendency when things get difficult? You know, you get a kid that a lot of things comes easy, and then they get to something that's difficult. What do? Put up their hands and want to walk away from it, right? Fortunately for us, that goes away when you're adult. You know, we don't have that problem as adults. We just attack everything head on, right? Okay, maybe we still wrestle with that all of our lives. But I wonder if it was something like that. You know, we're not given reasons in the scripture. I think I can say with reasonable confidence that this was a lack of faith on the part of the children of Israel. I mean, it was a lack of faith to say, oh, no, there's giants. We're not going in land. That's why they wandered for 40 years. When they said, we're going to trust God and go forward, they saw victories. Okay? But if these events happened after the life, after the death of Joshua, then this has been going on for years, 5, 10, 15, 20, 25 years. You know, it was 5 years they spent with the initial battles, and then when it was divided up, there were more things, you know, pockets of people to deal with. So even if, let's just say it was 5 or 10 years, do you think at a certain point they're like, I am tired of fighting? You know, I don't want to have to drive out any more people. I just want to go have my house and run my farm and, you know, enjoy some of this. And, you know, when does the constant war end? I mean, human nature tells us that was very likely. Okay? But I think that this and what we're going to see in the rest of the chapter here probably falls, you know, partly into that, you know, I'm tired of the fight category, as well as a lack of faith or a failure to depend on the Lord, because that's the ways that we've seen Israel fail previously. It says they could not drive them out. It was because of a failure on their part. It wasn't because God wasn't able. It says they have chariots of iron. It's kind of interesting to watch commentators try to fall all over themselves, you know, defining what that means. Some of them say this and some of them say that. Iron chariots would obviously be heavier than wood, harder for the horses to pull. So it may have been like a frame of iron and then it was a wood body. It may have been iron armor, you know, on the outside of it, or metal plating, which makes more sense to me. Some of the commentators also talk about how they added iron weapons to it, to the exterior of it as well. But nonetheless, that was an upgrade on those chariots. You see in the book of Joshua, you see it here, but God always told Israel not to keep the chariots. He wanted Israel to depend on him, but, you know, weaponry, that was a superior weapon. They didn't have a superior God, but when they came up against that obstacle, they backed off for whatever reason. So you have here the conquests of Judah summarized in verses 2 through 20, and then further on down in the chapter here, we see the conquest and failures of the other tribes. In verse 21, we see the house of Benjamin. The children of Benjamin did not drive out the Jebusites that inhabited Jerusalem, but the Jebusites dwell with the children of Benjamin in Jerusalem unto this day. That means at the time of the writing. And we know that the Jebusites held on to Jerusalem all the way till the time of David. It was David and his mighty men that drove them out, overtook the city, and that became the capital city for David. But you see Judah, and then you see Benjamin, which if we look at the map, Simeon is...
fat finger right here.
All right. Simeon, the pinkish-purplish here at the bottom, that huge area was the area given to Judah. It was so large, they gave Simeon an inheritance within there. So the green spot inside of the pinkish-purple is Simeon. And if you go right to the top of the Dead Sea there, there's an orange, a kind of a rust-brown color. It looks like a car body with no wheels on it to me. But that would be the territory of Benjamin. Okay, so you have Judah, and then you have Benjamin. And then, you know, right above that, the green and yellow, that was Ephraim and Manasseh. That was the children of Joseph. That's the next group we're going to talk about. Well, you know, Jericho is just above the top of the Dead Sea there. Gilgal is just above that. So that central area there is where their camp was. Judah left and went south. And then you have Benjamin and the children of Joseph right near Gilgal there. But we see in verse number 19 that the children of Judah did not drive out. We see in verse 21, the children of Benjamin did not drive out the Jebusites. And then in verse number 22, the house of Joseph went up against Bethel, and the Lord was with him. Now, I pronounce it that way on purpose, Bethel. That would be the Hebrew pronunciation, but also that kind of gives the meaning of the word. Beth is the word for house, and then El is the name of God, the short form. The longer form is Elohim. The house of God. When was it named Bethel? Remember? When Jacob deceived his father, and then mom said, you better go away for a while and let dad cool off. When Jacob had a dream while he was there at Bethel with the angels going up and down on the ladder and everything. We call it Jacob's ladder. I don't know why. I mean, it was the angel's ladder technically. But that was where he named it Bethel, because he said, this is the house of God, and I didn't realize it. Same area, okay? Originally called Luz, then he changed the name to Bethel. There's other mentions in Joshua and Judges to Luz, and some of the commentators think that maybe there were others that moved to another area and named a second city Luz as well. Could be the same city, could be two different ones. I mean, within 4 hours of here, there's three or four Greenvilles. Greenville, North Carolina, Greenville, South Carolina, Greenville, Tennessee. I'm pretty sure there's a Greenville, Virginia, too. I mean, it's not, those kinds of things are not unheard of, okay? But verse 22, the house of Joseph went up against Bethel, and the Lord was with him. And the house of Joseph sent to descry Bethel. That means that to spy it or to scope it out. Now, the name of the city before was Luz. And the spies saw a man come forth out of the city. And they said unto him, show us, we pray thee, the entrance into the city, and we will show thee mercy. Now, were they that blind that they couldn't see the city gate and the main entrance? No, that wasn't the issue. What does that mean? I mean, what I think happened here is that when here come the armies of the children of Israel, what did they do? They locked up the city. Well, then they found somebody that belonged there, and they said, if you show us how to get in, we'll spare the lives of you and your family members. Very often, you know, there was a not so obvious passageway in and out. Maybe it was what looked like a water drainage tunnel or whatever. But, you know, they found one of the inhabitants of the city here. Verse 25, when he showed them the entrance into the city, they smote the city with the edge of the sword, but they let the man go and all his family. And the man went into the land of the Hittites and built a city and called the name thereof Luz, which is the name thereof unto this day. All right, so he went and built another city and renamed it after the city that was conquered. Okay? But There's all kind of little interesting stories like that that are mixed throughout here. But what you have here is Judah first. Then verse 21 is Benjamin. Verse 22 is the house of Joseph, which includes both Ephraim and Manasseh. Okay, but now we saw in verse 19, Judah did not drive out. In verse 21, Benjamin did not drive out. Now look with me in verse number 27. Neither did Manasseh drive out the inhabitants of Beth Shean and her towns, or Tanakh and her towns, nor the inhabitants of Dor and her towns, or the inhabitants of Ibleam and her towns, or the inhabitants of Megiddo and her towns. So we have another neither did. You get this phrase five or six times in this chapter. Did not or neither did. I mean, you see it in verse 28 that they did not drive them out. Verse 29, neither did Ephraim. Verse 30, neither did Zebulun. Verse 31, neither did Asher. Verse 33, neither did Naphtali. There's a pattern going on here. Notice with me again in verse 27, neither did Manasseh drive out the inhabitants of Beth Shean and her towns, nor Tanakh and her towns, inhabitants of Dor and her towns. The last phrase, but the Canaanites would dwell in that land. Okay, that is a very specific statement there. That was a statement of intent. That was a statement of purpose. I mean, think about somebody you know, whether it's the person you look at in the mirror or whether it's somebody else that you know who just makes up their mind, I'm going to be stubborn on this point and I am not budging. Okay, you may have to think really, really hard to come up with an example of stubbornness, but if you try hard enough, you can probably come up with an example. I'm trying not to smile because most of us could probably model that ourselves, right? But it says they would not dwell. That word there for would not dwell means this. It's to make a volitional decision to commence a given activity. In other words, they made a choice and they acted on it. That's what that means. So what it says here in verse 27 is the Canaanites would dwell in that land. You know what they said? We ain't leaving. Bad grammar. We ain't leaving. And they decided they were going to stay and fight. And their resolve was greater than the resolve of the children of Israel. You see the exact same word down in verse number 34. The Amorites forced the children of Dan into the mountain, for they would not suffer them to come down into the valley. Same phrasing there. They made a decision. We're going to stand here. We are not giving in to you. We will fight you to the death. Now, there were others that had that resolve, and they had died before the armies of Israel. Did God's power change in these circumstances? You know the answer to that. The answer is no. What changed in these circumstances was the resolve of the children of Israel. Why did they could they not drive these people out? Why did they give up before they finished the job? In a word, got tired of it. I mean, that's one of the lessons that I think is prominent here in Judges 1 and 2 for us. I want to be careful. I'm not saying you get tired of serving God, but you get tired while serving God. You know, you get tired sometimes of being different. Or you get tired of the constant effort that's required to fight against the world, the flesh, and the devil. And if we're not careful, we can get tired of fighting and just give up and go with the flow and whatever. I mean, it's common with certain age groups. I've seen pastors get into their 60s and 70s and kind of get a just don't rock the boat mentality, go along to get along, where they used to take more of a firm stand on issues and things like that. But it's not limited to that age group. I mean, all of us are susceptible to the mentality of, I'm tired of this, I'm ready for something else. I think one of the lessons for us is to look at this neither did not, neither did not, and ask the Lord to renew our resolve, as long as He's left us here, to finish what He's given us to do, and to see the tasks through rather than say it's good enough. to see it through to completion. We got to stop there for today. Let's close in a word of prayer. Thank you, Lord, for today. Pray that you'd help us to hear, well done, good and faithful servant. Help us to finish the task that you've given us. And Lord, I pray that you would help us to trust you and see things through and not leave things for our children to deal with, as was done here by the Israelites. Help us to learn from these examples. And we pray now for every aspect of the service to follow, that you'd be pleased with it and that you'd meet with us in Jesus' name. Amen. Thank you, and you're dismissed.